You're listening to First Words, a podcast where creativity, career, and kids collide. We're your hosts, Jasmine Aluma.
And I'm Casey Gates Fry.
Today's guest is Rebecca Phillips Epstein, a screenwriter, essayist, and dramaturg originally from New York City. She writes candidly and often humorously about parenting, mental health, and everything in between. Essays about her miscarriage, being trolled by anti-Semitic conspiracy theorists, and her ADHD diagnosis at the age of 35 have appeared in publications like The Washington Post, Gaveller, McSweeney's, and Human Parts by Medium.
Rebecca wrote the pilot episode of the short-form anthology web series Hotspot, which was a 2020 Series Fest special selection. She was a writer's assistant on Emily in Paris and the Roseanne revival for ABC, and before that, she worked for comedy writer-producer Hillary Winston for 4 years. I'm curious to know what shifted in your writing after you entered parenthood, from that point of on the track that you were on pursuing TV writing to continuing to find your voice through parenthood.
Yes. So before I had a baby, I knew that I was a skilled writer. I know that I am funny and very modest. But I didn't know what made me different than every other shiny-haired Jewish girl from New York City with daddy issues who thinks she's funny. And so I had written things that were technically pretty good. You know, I was learning the craft, but I knew deep down that I hadn't found it yet. I hadn't found that elevator pitch of who are you as a writer? You know, what makes you special? What's your tone? Where do you excel? What kinds of stories do you tell? And I think I knew somewhere that I wasn't ready. So after I had Sam, I was still working for a showrunner with an overall deal at Sony. And I had opportunities to leave and go work as a writer's assistant on other shows that she would have, you know, been able to make introductions for and send me on my way. Leaving her was not something that I thought about lightly. And I didn't want to leave her unless it was really the right time and for something really special. Also, because I had a kid and she had a young daughter and she tended to hire a lot of other women and a lot of other moms. So it was such a special environment to be in where I got to have access to everything she did as a writer-producer. I got to sit in every meeting, meet everybody, and never had to hide that I was a parent, that parenting was important. And having all of those things in one environment showed me that it's possible and also sort of set me up to lean into those topics as a writer and as a person. And while I was working for her, I went through terrible postpartum depression with my first. And I knew it was coming for me because I've struggled with mental health issues my entire life. I've been diagnosed with anxiety and depression. I've been on and off medication a couple of times. And so I lined up a therapist ahead of time. I, you know, did all of the things that I knew I would need to do just in case. And then it came for me. But because this time there was another human life depending on me, the depression looked different. I was showering. I was cooking. I was doing the basic care tasks that 10 years earlier I was completely unable to do. So I thought it wasn't that bad. And I didn't know what postpartum OCD was. I didn't know what intrusive thoughts were. You know, and you shared that you had had some of that experience too. And I didn't know, you know, what it meant to every time I made a left-hand turn, imagine a car slamming into me. Every single time. And I didn't know how much that was taking out of me. I also, of course, didn't know I had undiagnosed ADHD, which makes everything more overwhelming. So I ended up in a place where I thought that I was doing fine and that this was just normal and that having a year-old baby was just kind of terrible, you know, and that everything just kind of was supposed to feel impossible. And then I had a moment where I realized how far gone I was. I sort of recognized patterns in my behavior that are not in line with who I am and my values, either like as a person, as a wife, as a mother. And I started medication again and kind of pulled myself back from the edge. And then months later, had the idea to write about that. And I wrote a new pilot while I was still working for Hillary. We were in production on a pilot of hers through Sony. And while I was assisting her on that, I was also writing my pilot Afterbirth, which is about a woman with severe postpartum depression, where the mental illness exists as a character within the world of the show. So it's kind of like Fight Club, but postpartum depression. She presents as the sort of toxic friend who just has tons of bad ideas, but is like really fun and seductive and pushes our main character into kind of iffy decisions, but makes her feel really good in the moment and makes her feel like something other than a wife and a mother. Finding that way to show what it feels like. You know, like, what is it like when you're depressed and you can't go to a party? Well, you could show a person taking on an outfit and, you know, putting on an outfit and taking it off a million times. You could show a person being late or being stressed out. But what if you could show a person lying on their bed with another person sitting on top of them physically, not letting them leave? You know, or telling them they look like shit, telling them that no one is going to like them, that they're going to embarrass themselves, handing them another drink when they've already had too much, telling them, you know, don't go get the baby when she's crying. She's fine. Stay with me on Instagram. What if you could show those things? So I wrote this pilot and I sort of, you know, it's very loosely based on the events from my life that led to ultimately getting through it. And I finished it and I showed it to my boss and she said, this is great. This is ready. I sent it out. I signed with Gersh right away after my agent read it and he started sending me out on general meetings. And I must have gone on like 10 meetings in a week the first week he sent it out. I mean, it was, everybody wanted to meet me and it was so exciting. And I kept walking into these meetings nervous, because it's a really raw, sort of gritty, very dark half-hour comedy. And I'd sit in these meetings and then like single dudes would say things like, that's exactly how I fight with my girlfriend. It's like you had a microphone in my kitchen. It was so real to me. And then I had a meeting with a woman who was 8.5 months pregnant who said, I'm not sure whether I'm glad I read this now at 8.5 months pregnant, or I wish I hadn't, but it just hit, you know, it hit me in that place. It felt true. And meeting after meeting, I started to gain an enormous amount of confidence that like, oh, that feeling I've had my whole life of people are going to be disappointed when they meet me. If they read Afterbirth and wanted to meet me, they were not going to be disappointed by the person who walked through the door. And that was the first time I had written something that I was like, this is me, not just because it's close to my actual story, but because it's the thing that I can do that makes me special. And that was the first time I saw it clearly of like, oh, I'm the person who says stuff out loud that other people don't want to or are afraid to because it might make them look bad. And I don't care if I look bad. I don't care if it's embarrassing. I don't care if it's painful. If it makes somebody else feel less alone and feel understood and hopefully makes them laugh, then it's worth it to me. And the point isn't necessarily to give people false hope or to be unnaturally optimistic. I'm not trying to make people feel better. I'm trying to make them feel less alone. And until I wrote that script, I did not know that. And that was the change. That was the moment when I found it, you know, and I don't believe that everything happens for a reason, but I do believe that it is our job to find meaning in what happens. And if you can find meaning in it, that is the reason. One of the first things they tell you when you get pregnant is that you shouldn't go sharing the news until you're safely in the second trimester, presumably to spare you the pain of having to announce a miscarriage. But in my case, my indiscretion proved to be a blessing in disguise. Because so many people already knew I was pregnant, I had no choice but to tell them about my loss. So suffering alone was simply not an option. I spent the rest of that day and most of the next surrounded by friends. They came over to feed me deep dish pizza, regale me with insane Tinder dating stories, perform crystal energy healings, whatever, it's LA, and eat a lot of CBD candy. Again, it's LA. My best friend in New York overnighted me the Crazy Rich Asian series. My favorite boss sent a huge bouquet of flowers. I texted with a former coworker who walked me through what to expect from the procedure and in the weeks and months that would follow. She warned me that I would be extra nervous when I got pregnant again and smartly advised that when people asked what they could do to help, I should tell them to bring alcohol.
You were diagnosed with ADHD at 35, and you wrote an article in the Washington Post about your decision to take medication for it. How has ADHD impacted your writing process? And then what changed when you started taking meds?
ADHD has always affected my writing process. I just didn't know it. You know, the Dorothy Parker quote, "I hate writing, I love having written." I thought that applies to everybody and that everybody who writes sits down and struggles to get those first words out. And many, many people do. Obviously, it's very common. But task initiation is one of the major issues that people with ADHD have, just getting started on something. And sometimes it's because of, you know, the monotony of the task. Sometimes it's because of fear of rejection of what will happen on the other side of the task. And, or just the enormity of the task and being unable to break it down into small enough chunks that feel doable. And so I just thought I was a procrastinator, an incorrigible procrastinator who could not be helped, and that any amount of talent that I did have paled in comparison to my laziness and lack of work ethic, and that that was the reason that everybody was lapping me and that I was not yet where I thought I should be, and why, you know, in spite of being good at things and very smart, I kept finding myself not succeeding in environments where by all rights I should have. And knowing that I'm a creative person with tons of ideas, and then knowing that I will probably never write most of them, had for literal decades made me feel like a failure before I had even ever started. After getting diagnosed, you know, at first, like a lot of people, there was this elation, right? Of I've spent 30 years wondering what's wrong with me, and actually nothing is wrong with me. My brain is just different. And now that I know this, I can work with my brain instead of against my brain. And nothing is wrong with me. Nothing is wrong with me. And that was such an incredible and freeing thought. But then, of course, I realized that taking medication was not going to suddenly make me shit out screenplays. I sort of hoped that it would. But this is the myth, right? You know, when people take Adderall recreationally, we've all heard jokes about what happens. But for a person whose brain needs stimulants to function normally, that is not what happens. It gives you the self-regulation to do the things you need to do, but you have to do them. A friend of mine compared meds to a ladder. The ladder is not going to get you over the wall unless you point it at the wall. And so I think having medication that helped me regulate and helped me make more intentional choices was one very small piece of the puzzle, because for 30 years, I'd been developing other habits and other neural pathways, and things that I thought were just process turned out, of course, to be coping mechanisms and uncontrolled symptoms. And so unlearning those things and trying to rewire my brain and create entirely new habits and processes around, what tools do I use to write? How do I write? How do I trick myself into writing in a way that feels less pressured? How do I break it down into small chunks when the goal is huge and the ambition is huge? And so I am able to forgive myself more when I procrastinate, you know, when I start something late. And I'm also able to say, I know that I, even if I lock myself into this room, I am not going to start this until 4 p.m. So I'm not going to do it. I'm going to go play with my kids and I'm not going to start till 4. And I'm going to take a nap and know that I'll probably be up all night. And that's okay. And I'll just have to crash the next day. And that's fine too. you know, I used to also lose a lot of ideas because I'd be in the shower and inspiration would strike. And I would say to myself, this idea is so great. Write it down. I don't have time right now. I won't forget this. This is such a great idea. How could I forget this? And inevitably I would. And so now when I have the idea, because often my writing comes fully formed, the whole sentences and paragraphs will just appear. And if I do not sit down and write them down, they will be gone forever. And I can try to recapture it, but it's never as good. And so I know now that I am particularly early in the day and late in the evening when I'm not on medication, my creativity is a bit more unruly. And if that thunderbolt appears, I have to sit down and do it. And I do, and I just stop what I'm doing and I do it. And I say to my husband, I have to go. And he knows what that means and he knows what it is. And he had seen me do that previously, but now we all know why. And the knowing why is so freeing and comforting and powerful and, you know, has given me a framework to recognize, oh, I'm doing it again. Maybe I don't have to do it this way. And just little things like knowing that ADHD gets its name because of how it presents clinically as a deficit of being able to pay attention. But chemically, many people believe that it is actually a dopamine deficiency in the regulatory centers of the brain. And so a lot of ADHD symptoms are actually dopamine-seeking behaviors because without dopamine, without the neurotransmitter dopamine, you cannot self-regulate. And so you're going to go look for it in food, in sex, in movement, in exciting new hobbies. And the minute something stops giving you that dopamine rush, then you're not interested in it anymore, which is why ADHD people are idea people, but not necessarily follow-through people. Because having the brilliant idea feels so much better than sitting down and actually doing it, which is something I think everybody can relate to. Remembering somebody's name at a party is boring. The story they tell is not boring. I can remember everything that somebody told me in a conversation, what they were wearing, and forget their name because that is not as interesting to me. There's no dopamine there, but there's dopamine for them. In terms of the writing, it's sort of finding ways to give myself that dopamine. And I have all kinds of little tricks I've picked up along the way to make things feel more fun and more exciting and smaller and more doable. I give myself rewards. I use timers. I try Pomodoro. I write things by hand, you know, depending on the mood that I'm in. I also do a voice recorder and voice to text sometimes because it's easier to edit than to write on a blank page. And with the scripts, you know, writing outlines is very easy because it feels like it's not final, right? It's a draft. So I'll write an outline, but then I will put the outline into my screenwriting program and reformat it as a screenplay and turn anything that might be an action line into an action line. And any dialogue in the outline, I will actually format as dialogue. So when I go to write the script, I already have 10 pages of things that look like script. And so then I feel like I've already started. And that's a trick I learned from Hillary, who I do not believe has ADHD, but there's nobody who doesn't benefit from better executive functioning and from little tricks that make things feel easier. So just, I'm just collecting and collecting and collecting those things.
You just shared so much information with us about ADHD that I know that's going to, there are going to be some light bulbs going off for people, you know, whether that's, maybe I have ADHD too, or my brain, I don't think I do, but my brain functions in such a way that this is absolutely going to help me and reframe the way that I think about my working self.
I really hope that somebody does have that moment and go, wait a minute, that's me, that's my spouse, that's my kid. And since my diagnosis, even just talking to friends socially, 6 or 7 of my friends have gotten diagnosed just because of conversations we've had. And it usually starts with, wait, I didn't know that was ADHD. Say more. Where did you learn that? How did you hear that? And for me, after 30 years of sitting around going, what's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? It was a tweet. I was on Twitter in May of 2020, and I saw a Twitter friend had retweeted this thread by a Canadian writer who writes often about ADHD, who I didn't even follow. And, you know, I read through the thread and it was something along the lines of, you know, of all the things that caused me to suggest that people might want to get themselves to a therapist, It is when I hear somebody say that they are lazy and that they feel terrible about it. Because here's the thing about lazy people. They don't care that they're lazy. They don't care that they're late. They don't care that they disappoint you. They don't care that their home is a wreck. They don't care. And so if you are struggling to do things that you want to do, that you know you can do, that you are capable of doing, and that there's no good reason to not do, but you cannot make yourself do it, allow me to suggest that perhaps you are not lazy and perhaps it is not your fault. Often the hyperactivity, for me anyway, was more sort of mental. So you can have hyperactivity in your thoughts. You can have verbal hyperactivity and impulsivity. So that's that motor mouth, that interrupting, you know, talking constantly. Kids who get described as annoying. So, which doesn't mean you have ADHD if you're annoying, but it is an annoying set of behaviors. And so kids with ADHD tend to be behind their peers socially 2 to 3 years anyway, partly because they have behaviors that other kids find annoying, so they don't have as many opportunities to socialize because people don't include them. Partly because they don't have the self-regulation to be able to read social cues and then do what is expected of them. And even if they know what's expected of them, sometimes they can't do it. You know, that's those kids where they know the classroom rules and they keep breaking them. You know, they keep interrupting the teacher. They keep forgetting where they're supposed to be. They keep stopping in the middle of an assignment. And I learned that often with kids with ADHD, socially, one of three things will happen. A social interaction will not go well, and either they will think it has gone well when it has not because they had a great time and did not notice what anyone else was doing. Or they will know it has not gone well, but have no idea why, because they were not paying attention to other people's cues because they were doing something interesting to them. Or, and this is what almost always happened and continues to happen with me, a social interaction will not go well. They will have a pretty good idea as to why and be completely unable to correct the behavior in the future, because they don't have the self-control. And they're all heartbreaking. And I always wondered, like, why am I not more popular? Why don't people like me more? Why do people think I'm annoying? I'm not any more annoying than anyone else, you know? And I think I'm more likable than other people, but they don't like me as much. Why? You know, and of course, learning then that having a brain that's wired this way leads to a totally different communication style. I was on social media last night and I saw a reel of someone who talks a lot about neurodivergent brains, saying that anecdotal communication is more common in people with autism and ADHD, where like you'll tell me a story about going to a concert, and instead of saying, wow, that's amazing, what did he sing? I might say, oh my God, I saw him last summer. And if you're somebody either from a cultural background where that type of conversation is more common, or your brain works this way, you will see that interjection as connection. As me going, I'm with you, I'm interested in what you have to say. And then you'll just say more and you won't wait for me to ask the question. But often with neurotypical people, that kind of interruption can make them think, can be read as, I'm not interested in what you have to say. I'm interested in my experience. And now I'm taking this conversation. Now, this is a behavioral adjustment, you know, because after decades of, I mean, also coming from a New York Jewish upbringing where interrupting is a part of conversation. And it's really interesting because this is actually something that Samara Bay and I have talked about a lot. About, she's the one who explained to me that culturally, there are different ways of taking pauses and of asking and answering questions. And that in certain places and in certain cultures, overlapping speech and overlapping agreement, what someone else might see as interruption, is actually a way of agreeing and affirming, and that those patterns, depending on where you're from and what you heard growing up, you will either hear that interruption as somebody like lifting you up and being with you, or it will be really offensive. And it also has a lot to do with where you're from. And I think that was such an interesting thing to consider, because after my diagnosis, none of my friends were surprised, but many of them had, you know, reactions along lines of like, well, yeah, you're just a theater person, or I mean, you're a New Yorker. I mean, like, we're all like that. And to an extent, I have gravitated towards environments and people who share those types of communication patterns and who share sort of that thing I have of being a heat heat-seeking missile for good ideas, because I feel like what I bring to the table in an improvisatory way is really valuable. And I don't know that I have used my improv training ever in my life quite as much as I do now as the mother of two young boys. I can play forever. I can make up stories forever. I can do puppet shows forever. And to see them connect and the joy that they have and that I can keep them on a schedule by creating a game. And then it's not, I don't have to constantly yell at them, especially now that I'm medicated and I'm so much less overwhelmed. I am able to say like, okay, we need to be in this place by this time, but I can take it one step at a time and I don't have to freak out 90 minutes before we have to walk out the door because what if we're late? I can give them space and I can recognize the difference now and I can allow for the fun and for, you know, mostly following their lead and using those skills that I do have to be super present in a way that I think I never was able to before I knew this about myself, because I was always kind of hovering overhead above myself, wondering like, what should I be doing instead? Where should I be instead? How much time do I have to do this? Am I doing a good enough job? Like, and now I allow myself to just say like, this is what I am doing right now and I am not doing anything else.
In full disclosure, after reading your Washington Post article, I took that information directly to my therapist and was like, this is what she said. And this is what I experience. And like, and you describe it as like putting noise canceling headphones on your brain. And I was like, that, like, I want that. Which it didn't, she pulled out her book and we had a conversation about it. It did not result in a diagnosis, but what it did result in is having a more compassionate understanding of my brain, the way that my brain works. And now I'm not beating myself up about it. In my head, I'm just like, oh, this is how my brain works. Now let me figure out a way to work with that instead of like hating myself because of it and negative self-talk.
You know, the piece that I'm working on right now is about the moment that it all sort of clicked for me after my diagnosis. About 2 months after my diagnosis in August of 2020, I bought a dustbuster. I really hate cleaning and I really struggle with that type of task and always have. Now I know because of ADHD, like it's boring, it's monotonous and there's no dopamine, you know. And for years, I really beat myself up like, you're a slob, you're disgusting. Vacuuming has always been one of the hardest things. And when you have kids, you are never more aware that your floor is filthy than after you have children. And I would just stare at this dirty floor and like, just be like, get up and vacuum and do it. And the only solution I could come up with to my resistance to vacuuming was to just like, not be such a piece of shit and just vacuum. The only solution was, well, then make yourself vacuum. Become a person who vacuums. Stop being this person who can't vacuum and vacuum. And then after the diagnosis, I said like, well, hold on. What is actually, is it that I can't vacuum or is there something hard about it that is not what I think that it is? And I realized like, oh, the vacuum is in this cabinet behind the garbage can. And so I have to like move the garbage, open the thing, carry it into another room, unwind the cord, plug it in, move the chairs, do the thing. And so it had not occurred to me to buy a hand vacuum because my vacuum cleaner has a dustbuster attachment. But then after the diagnosis, when I'm like, oh, this is like 15 horrible steps. I'm never going to do this. I am never, ever going to be a person who uses this vacuum cleaner ever. So I ordered a dustbuster from Amazon and I plugged it in on top of the bookshelf within arm's reach of my chair at the dining table so that I didn't even have to stand up to pick it up. I mean, it's an eyesore. It's ugly. It's, you know, a redundant piece of equipment. And pick it up and just vacuum up the cereal, the whatever. And suddenly the question shifted from how do you make yourself vacuum to how do you get a clean floor? The second question has nothing to do with my abilities, my personality, my self-control, my virtue, nothing. There's no moral component to how do I keep the floor clean? How do I do it? And so like dustbuster logic has become shorthand in my house for, are we asking the right question about this thing? Is there an easier way to do this? Is there a shortcut? Is there a cheat code? Is there some way that I can come at this problem from a different direction that takes my own personal failures out of the equation so that they're not actually failures, because the only failure was I asked the wrong question.
I love it. There's always another way.
According to my psychiatrist, I am the textbook example of how ADHD gets missed in high-achieving girls. And over the years, I'd become so adept at masking my symptoms that no one but me ever suspected there was a problem. My diagnosis at age 35 was an enormous relief, and I hoped that medication would give me a shot at finally feeling normal. But if I wanted to keep nursing my six-month-old baby, normal might have to wait. There are no controlled studies of stimulants during pregnancy and lactation, my psychiatrist explained. So while there's no evidence that they're harmful, there's no proof that they're safe either. As I understood it, I had two options. I could quit breastfeeding and take medication, or continue breastfeeding and delay treatment. Neither was ideal. On one hand, I'd made it this far without meds, so what was another 6 months? On the other, hadn't I suffered enough? With the green light from my son's pediatrician, my psychiatrist prescribed an immediate-release stimulant I could try on an as-needed basis. I would nurse and pump beforehand and bottle feed while the meds were in my system. She also recommended I pump and dump after each dose to further minimize exposure. A few days later, I stood in my kitchen, staring down at a small blue pill in the palm of my hand. A wave of guilt washed over me. Was I doing the right thing? Would it even make a difference? Turns out the difference was enormous. When the meds kicked in, it felt like someone had slipped a pair of noise-canceling headphones onto my brain. I had no idea how loud it was in there until suddenly it was quiet. I knew I couldn't go back to the way things were before. I also knew that spending most of those clear-headed hours attached to a pump was a waste of time and milk. As my supply and my resolve dwindled in equal measure, I was ready to be done. So I hung up my nursing bras for good, and I have never once regretted it.
Jasmine and I love talking about matrescence. And when we discovered this word, we were so excited that there was a word for the transition a woman makes into new motherhood. And so we would love to hear your perspective on this, as well as like your experience of it and kind of your thoughts.
So I love this question. I love this word. I've thought a lot about it. And the best way that I can describe what it felt like for me is in terms of the movie Inside Out, the Pixar movie. When I first saw the movie, it was before I had had kids. And then when I saw it again after having kids, I recognized something. I sort of compare it to, like, you know, when you're watching a movie and the first island of personality crumbles. Like, she's got five islands of personality that power her psyche and her personality and who she is. And each one is powered by these core memories, right? She's got five of them. And then the core memory goes dark and the island falls and it is gone. And I remember the first time I watched that movie being absolutely devastated, bursting into tears because she used to be five things and now she is four things. And I know from having watched the movie that at the bottom of that ravine are the broken pieces of that island. And there is no putting it back together. It did not seem possible that that thing could ever be put back together the way that it was before. So now she's just compromised. She's just less than she was before. And of course, as the movie goes on, the rest of the islands fall. And by the end, she's got seven and they're hybrid islands and they're bigger and more complex and include pieces of the originals, right? And you realize that this is the metaphor for maturing and growing up and having a more sophisticated personality as happens as we get older. And I think for me, the postpartum depression was as much intellectual as it was like chemical, because I had that experience of feeling like I used to be five things and now I am four things. And that fifth thing, that like one-way ticket, pickleback, whiskey shots, karaoke, like wild, sexually free person is gone. She is gone and she has been replaced with nothing. And like the first time I saw the movie, it did not occur to me what, if anything, could ever take her place, let alone that it would be something that included pieces of who I was before. And I wouldn't necessarily say that I'm all the way there yet, that I know what that thing is, but I can feel it building. I can feel it getting more sophisticated. I was just talking to my husband about this last night, about like so many of the things that made me who I was are antithetical to thoughtful, consistent, loving, nurturing, strong parenting. And so how do you find yourself when you're doing a job where in order to do it well, you have to do things that don't suit you, that don't send your life into the kind of flow that you're used to or that is productive for you, especially as a creative person. But much like by the end of that movie, it's like, oh, I just didn't see it because you're so with that character that, you know, and the rules of the world have been explained to you. There are these five memories. They power these five islands. Like, that is what there is. And we lost one and that's it. Nobody explains to you that it is going to be this constant process of rebuilding and rebuilding and rebuilding, right? And they're going to be hybrid memories and they're going to be not just happy or sad, but happy and sad. And that concept of bittersweet and ambivalence and complexity evolves with a person as they grow up. And becoming a mother is just like another one of those moments, you know, like when you kind of that like 10, 11 year old age, when they shift from being still little kids into kind of like preteens. And then there's puberty, right? And then there's independence around 18. You go off, you leave your parents' house, you go to college or whatever you go do. And becoming a parent is just another moment of breaking and remaking, of maturing and changing and growth. My dad has a number of sayings that he repeats, and one of them is, every choice entails a loss. Every time you have a choice before you, to make that choice, you must give up something because you can't choose both. And if it wasn't a choice worth making, it wouldn't be a hard one. And you have to walk into those choices prepared to give up the thing you're not choosing. And as prepared as I was to like raise a kid, that's a different thing than being a mother. And I wasn't prepared to sacrifice because like I was 30 and didn't think I would have to. I thought that somehow I would be the one who could like continue on in my career and make it all work. And even though I kept working and worked consistently full time until my son was almost three, my oldest, and then I sort of was working on shows and had more time in between things. But I was the full-time person in our house for a long time, even after having a kid. And yet you can't do it the same way. You have to find those moments for yourself, carve out personal time on a schedule. And that remains hard for me. And so I've watched other people I came up with kind of reach different points in their careers, some of them because they do not have children. And so they were able to take different risks and opportunities at a time when I was not or didn't want to, or just didn't have them put in front of me for whatever reason. And then I have other friends who waited a long time to have kids until they were already established. And I wonder sometimes where I'd be, but I also know for sure that I would not have found my voice in the same way, that like, what I lost to like drunk one night stand karaoke island, I gained in I'll go first island. I became that truth teller, that person to my friends, to my colleagues, and to strangers on the internet now that I'm publishing more and more. After my Washington Post piece came out, I got messages and messages and messages through my website on DM, like text messages from friends, people from high school reaching out. Either because they'd been struggling with breastfeeding and they didn't have anyone to tell, or they thought they might have ADHD, they wanted to talk about it, you know, or they just felt, or their kid is struggling with mental health stuff. And I would love to get paid more than I do, but on a pure level, like I know for sure that this is my purpose. This is why I'm here, is to say this stuff out loud that has happened to me. It is why these things happened to me. When I had my miscarriage, the first thing that I'm sitting in the OB's office after I'm dressed, you know, after I've had the ultrasound and I get dressed and we're sitting in our office and we're going to talk about what happens next. And I was sitting there sort of in that like haze, like right after you hear a really loud noise when your ears are sort of reverberating and everything is fuzzy. And my brain is going like, why is this happening to me? Why is this happening to me? Oh, I'm going to write about it. And it took me another year to do it. But I went home and I took notes that day. I wrote down everything that happened, the things that were said to me, what everything looked like. I wrote down every single thing that happened all the way through my DNC procedure and after, because I knew I was going to come back to it and write about it, because I decided in that moment, this is why it's happening to me, because I am going to write about this. I'm going to do something with it. I'm going to turn it into something, you know? And I think that plays nicely with just my personality. I am an experience junkie. Like, I am very, very greedy for life experiences. I want them all. And so when things happen to me, I have started looking at it as, well, it's happened to me so that I can tell somebody about it, so that I can help somebody. Because if it's happening to me, I am not that special. I am not the only person in the world who's having this experience. And if I am feeling lonely, then someone else is too. And maybe I can make them feel less lonely. And then as I've shifted more into prose and putting out these essays and freelance writing, the responses that I'm getting from people, people in television and film that I've been wanting to impress for years, you know, are following this in a way that I don't know that they were following me before. And I'm just really finally starting to feel like maybe this is what I was supposed to do all along. And in the quiet of the pandemic, with my diagnosis, with doing Zoom kindergarten, not being able to work because my husband's on set full time, and all of the resentment and anger and frustration I felt at that, asking myself, well, what can I do? Okay, I can do this. And then having that experience be what brought me back to the writer I was when I was 20, like writing these personal essays that gave people a lens to look at the world and themselves differently, and feeling like this is the truest expression of my voice. And it is, again, a product of things that happened that I might not have chosen, but as a result of being a mother, because it's inseparable from being a person at this point. So, when are you going to give Sam a little sister or brother? In that moment, it would have been so easy to give a discreet, socially appropriate response that moved the conversation along without offending anyone. But I did not do that. Instead, I looked her straight in the eye and told the truth. Actually, I just had a miscarriage a few weeks ago. I saw her expression change as the conversation suddenly shifted from small talk to real talk. I felt a twinge of guilt that I couldn't just let it go. Oh, she said, I'm so sorry. She took a breath, and then she said something else, something I didn't expect. You know, I had so much trouble getting pregnant that I ended up using a donor egg. Then the other mother chimed in. It was hard for us, too. It took us almost a year to get pregnant the second time. Far from being offended, they both seemed almost relieved that I had opened the door to a conversation that women just don't have out in the open all that often. Over the last year, my unflinching candor has led to its fair share of awkward moments. But more often than not, when I'm willing to go first and just say out loud, I had a miscarriage, the next thing I hear is some version of, yeah, me too.
I think what you spoke to earlier about personhood and parenthood being so enmeshed, it is, you are writing about this, these experiences in parenthood, having the evolution of your personality and identity shift. And also, I think it's a time where we are craving those stories. And like you bring up Inside Out, which is a uniquely beautiful story about adolescence and growing up. But there are so many stories about puberty because it also happens to men. Mm-hmm. And the fact that matrescence does not happen to men, of course they shift when men become fathers, but it's different on a chemical, biological, physical, every level you can imagine, different for women. And so like, I think it's just like syncing up so beautifully for your writing that you're coming into this, these experiences, and you're putting stories out that we need so bad right now.
I mean, I need them.
Yes,
that's why I wrote the breastfeeding essay for the Washington Post. Yeah. I mean, it was very on brand for me that like my first national byline is like, let me tell you about my boobies and my mental health issues. Like, of course it was. Of course I'm talking about like mental illness and my tits in the Washington Post the first time I get published there. Of course I am, because it's me. And I am. But I wrote it because I wanted to. That's what I wish I had been able to find, because I did, you know, as I wrote in the essay, right after my diagnosis, when we were talking about medication, you know, I'm Googling like breastfeeding, Adderall side effects, terrible mother, baby dead, like what, you know, and I'm looking for something. I'm looking for it. And there was nobody talking about this particular intersection. And when I pitched Amy Joyce at the Washington Post, she wrote me back 15 minutes later to take the pitch. She said, I have never seen this before. Let's do it. And because it wasn't there, it didn't exist. And we're always told, you know, write the thing that only you can write, but also write the thing that you want to read. Write the movie you want to see. Write the story you need to hear.
This is the podcast we want to exist. So we were like, why isn't there a podcast about creative writing, parenting?
And, you know, it's funny because I want one of the things that I did a couple months before the pandemic, I reached out to a few women that I know who are parents who were at a similar stage in their careers to me. They were writer's assistant, script coordinator level, or like they had developed something or they had staffed an animation, but they were sort of at that just about to pop place. So through Twitter and my personal life and just friends of friends, I had, there were like three or four other women that I knew who had children around the same age as mine, who were at a similar stage in their career. And I reached out to all of them and said, would you guys be interested in a writer's group? Like a writer's group for people who have kids this age who are at the same stage in our careers, because there aren't that many of us. And I needed that support of like just going out for my first staffing meetings or navigating the demands of being a writer's assistant, which is a very low status job, while also being a parent, which is a very high status job. And, you know, having other people that were going through the exact same thing, I just didn't know enough of them and they didn't know each other. And so I created this writer's group. And now three of them have staffed since then and are like now staff writers and are working. Another is like developing an animation. She's continued to rise. And then the last one is like winning all these contests with her new script that we all read. But, you know, I created this group because I was like, I need this exact kind of support. It doesn't exist. I'm going to make it. And, you know, this is why, this is how I ended up on your couch, because when I saw Samara post the trailer for this show, I immediately just texted her and said, like, I'm so excited that this exists.
Yay.
You know, and then she introduced me to you. But it's, what else are we supposed to do? You know, I think, too, becoming a mother, it's like I'm out of time for anything that is a waste of my time. And I think it's why I could go and like do more writer's assistant jobs and like be in more rooms. But, you know, I don't know that I really want to spend the rest of my career trying to only have ideas that please 13 white guys named Dave, which isn't to say I don't love television or writing television. I do. And I still want that shot and I know that I'll have it. But the way that the system is set up currently, there's not space for me, who is not a person that does well in a low status job. You know, like I need to be able to bring my whole self or else I'm going to fail. And that's the other gift of like the diagnosis, but also of parenthood, of like you are so acutely aware that if you do not bring your whole self, it's not going to work. And so I know myself better and I just do not have time for people and things that make me feel small or make me feel like I can't do what I know I'm good at. And, you know, it's all just related. And so sometimes that feels frustrating, but mostly now it feels powerful again. So I don't know what this new island of personality is going to be, but I don't know, but something.
What were your son's first words?
My oldest was a book. I know. And my second was, I don't remember. I actually don't remember what it was. I think it was probably Mama or Dada. He talked late.
It's classic with a second.
Yeah.
I have no idea. What was the first thing you said when you saw each of your sons?
I think I just said hi. It wasn't anything I thought about. I didn't, I tried not to think about it because I didn't want to be too precious. But with our second, I did make a playlist. I made like a playlist for like when I was pushing.
Uh-huh.
And I believe that Here Comes the Sun was playing when he was born.
What are the first words of your current project?
Get up, you lazy piece of shit, I say to myself. It is 8:30 on a Tuesday night. I am staring across the cluttered L-shaped living room at chunks of dried out mac and cheese on the dining room carpet.
Perfect. Mm-hmm. All right. And now we'll do a word association. So what is the first word that comes to mind when I say surrender?
Fear.
Rebuild.
Mountain.
Unlock.
Door.
Efficiency.
Stress.
Purpose.
Writing.
Thirst.
Water.
Truth.
Book.
Yeah.
You've been listening to First Words. You can find out more info on this episode's guest and the show on our website, firstwordspodcast.com. If this show resonated with you, please share it with other writer parents in your life. We're in this together. First Words is recorded, edited, and co-produced by James Hilmer.